How is being an artist different than a machine that is programmed to perform a set of actions? How can we stop thinking about artworks as objects and start thinking about them as triggers for experiences? In this conversation with Max Cooper, we discuss the beauty and chaos of nature and the exploration of technology, music, and consciousness.
Max Cooper is a musician with a PhD in computational biology. He integrates electronic music with immersive video productions inspired by scientific exploration. His latest project, Seme, commissioned by the Salzburg Easter Festival, merges Italian musical heritage with contemporary techniques, was also performed at the Barbican in London. He supplied music for a video narrated by Greta Thunberg and Pope Francis for the COP26. In 2016, Cooper founded Mesh, a platform to explore the intersection of music, science, and art.
Max Cooper, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you.
I'm excited to go into discussing Seme, this really immersive audiovisual work. But first, to help us get to know a little bit about you, I found it intriguing as a kind of expansion on your Unspoken Word series. You ask this question now of collaborators in your audience. I want to know how you feel and what it's like to exist inside your mind. What would you like to say that you cannot say in everyday life?
So that was related to Unspoken Words and the forthcoming a new project that I'm working on. Yeah, that was something that came from that project, which was sort of the question I challenged myself with that I tried to express in that album. And then I was interested in, if I asked that same question to everyone else, well, what does it mean to everyone else? And can I build another project around other people's interpretations of us all battling to understand what we are and who we are and what we should do and just existing in this strange life that we do? And I guess that's what a lot of art is about, you know, it's this sort of our struggle with the human condition. So yeah, I set the question to everyone else and it's crazy. A lot of the stuff I've got from people is really beautiful, terrible, emotional, just all sorts of human expression. It's a gold mine that I'm sort of mining at the moment to try and figure out what I can do with it. Yeah.
Tell us about your upbringing, your path to music. What are those unspoken things to help us get to know you?
I mean, Unspoken Words was my attempt to describe that. I find it so difficult to use words to, you know, I can describe technically things as a scientist, you know, and we have language to describe, you could say the neural correlates of consciousness, right? You could describe what they are and how the brain functions and behaves in an objective manner, but that really doesn't seem to get anywhere near the question of what it's actually like to be a human. To get to that, I need, you know, music essentially for me is I can sit down and I can make a chord progression and make a musical structure that resonates with how I feel at that moment and seems to capture things which go beyond anything I can put into words. And that was the idea of the Unspoken Words project, to try and capture those things and then interpret them with visual artists. And for me, that's as close as I can get to describe what it's like being me. So yeah, I'd say you just have to listen to the music and then you'll hear what it's like, I suppose. At least I can capture snapshots of myself that way.
Yeah, I know it's a difficult question that you're posing to other people, but yes, the music speaks for you. Tell us about some of your earliest musical memories and just your journey towards music.
Music was always there as I was growing up. My mum was a music teacher. My dad was an engineer. So there was always that sort of music and science was around me. But I didn't really engage with music seriously until I found electronic music. Something about the purity and the simplicity of electronic music really grabbed me. I mean, I was always drawn to chord progressions, but electronic music seems to purify a lot of musical form down to something which can become too rigid, but it really drew me in. And then I got into the whole club scene and, you know, started DJing and all that. So I came to music in a serious way much later than I'd come to the sciences, for example. I'd always been studying sciences and progressing that career well ahead of my, you know, wanting to delve into music. But music was always there and it always connected with me emotionally. And then I just found at some point that if I sat down and tried to render how I felt musically, it led to interesting results and music people enjoyed. So I just kept pursuing that and then linking in my scientific interests. That was the next thing. I didn't want to only do music. I didn't want to only do science. So it was, how can I tie everything together and visual arts? How can I tie all these interests together? So I started experimenting with taking my interest in science and commissioning visual artists essentially to make science-related ideas and work collaborating with people interested in the same sorts of things, and then building a system for playing that, you know, playing visuals and the music in live contexts. And then, yeah, I just followed that path down to where I am now.
And tell us about SEMME and how it originated. You've brought it now to the Salzburg Festival, and it has all these immersive elements of going back and celebrating Italian history.
Yeah, that was a commission. So Salzburg Festival is the classical and opera festival, a very well-renowned one. And I think each year they have some sort of electronic-related project that, you know, amongst this non-electronic program. So they asked if I could do that. And they said that their program this year was around Italy, so Italian opera, Italian classical music. And they said, can I do some sort of electronic project which is linked to Italy? So that was quite an unusual brief, but it was quite nice actually doing a project that wasn't my own brief, just to follow, just to, again, it led me to things that I wouldn't have done otherwise, some musical discoveries and interesting visual collaborations. So I just started thinking about how I could link Italy to my usual process of scientific related visuals and electronic music. Some of the initial ideas were, see, the famous Fibonacci sequence, for example, you know, and Cardano circles was this another historic Italian scientist who had this system for converting lines into circles, which was used in early printing presses. And I started delving into, you know, Italian historic science and aesthetics, as well as music, to see what I could find, what I could bring into my show. And I came up with this idea of SEMME, meaning seed. Basically, I was looking for historic aesthetics, musically, scientifically, visually, but also linking this idea of foundational aesthetics to the sciences more generally. So putting in things like symmetry and cellular automata, and putting in these other projects I've done previously, which also had this concept of simple systems, which give rise to a lot of the complexity that we see around us. So I was sort of taking this idea of seed, both culturally as well as scientifically, and I'm trying to, and that allowed me to basically link in older projects, which I already had, to this new concept. So that's how, you know, because I couldn't make a whole 90 minutes or 2 hours worth of content. It was way too much work. But I could make half an hour of new content or 45 minutes or whatever it was, and then link it in with all this old stuff and combine it all together into some sort of coherent story with that idea. So that's where SEMME came from.
Yes. And we're also inspired culturally, not just within Europe, but beyond, by Italy. These, you take the piece of music in Palestrina. Tell us that story.
Yeah, Palestrina was one of the main discoveries, like interesting and beautiful discoveries for me, because I was delving into a lot of historic Italian music, and a lot of it just didn't really lend itself to what I'm interested in musically. A lot of it was commissioned by very grand people for very grand places to sound very grand, and that didn't really resonate with me. But when I found Palestrina, it was music from the 1500s that was written for worship, for it was church music, really. And it was just for voices. It didn't have extra instrumentation, so it was fairly minimalist in that sense, but it was full of beautiful harmonies and this really reflective feeling. And the harmonies and the reflection really lend itself to a lot of the things I like musically already. I was able to take these original scores from Palestrina with the help of Neil Sorens and Tom Hodge and Kim Sheehan and Sarah Aristidou. We worked together on these things, but we were able to take the original scores and more or less keep the Palestrina as it was. There was one of the pieces that we modulated a little bit into a more slightly more modern scale, and we slowed them both down as well to give each, you know, harmony more breathing space. But essentially we could stick to the original scores, and then Sarah and Kim sang the vocal layers and I played synth layers and Tom played piano. And yeah, it just was a really nice musical discovery, which I wouldn't have come across if I hadn't had that unusual brief of trying to make a project around Italy.
It seems like with your audiovisual work, you're always interested in going underneath and showing us ways to go beyond what drives the systems of nature. Yeah. What is beauty?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's maybe a reductionist approach from remnant of having worked in the sciences for a long time. I always want to know what's underneath, how do we reduce further down? And the flip side to that is that I find the most beautiful projects are the ones where I can map a natural system explicitly. Because there's two ways of doing things. You know, a lot of my projects, if I'm approaching some sort of very human idea, for example, like I would be with Unspoken Words, it has to be quite interpretive. Often there's not like a quantitative system I can represent. But I really love when I'm working with a natural system, which is real, really boiled down to something. I mean, Fibonacci sequence is an example of that, or the distribution of the primes, or the digits of pi in a tree map, or waves, or symmetry. There's these ideas which are really foundational to science and really foundational to nature, but are really boiled down to simple quantitative systems. Even also emergence of cellular morphogenesis, for example. I find that whenever I do a project with a visual artist where we're representing something really boiled down in nature, instead of seeing the artistry of the artist or my idea, what we see is the artistry of nature. And the artistry of nature is always richer than the artistry of a human, in my opinion. And also these ideas, they're always full of mystery, that you can take the simplest ideas like the distribution of the prime numbers, the numbers that can only be divided by themselves or by one, and how they're interspersed amongst the non-primes. And it's a really simple boiled down system, but one that we still battle with. Mathematicians, they still haven't totally solved how they are interspersed and how the structure works. And nature seems to be full of these sorts of inexplicable, but really aesthetically rich ideas when you boil it down. And it's finding those things that's led me to want to find more of them, just because I find artistically, it's almost like nature foundationally is built in an artistic manner. Quantum mechanics is another very well-known example of this sort of thing, where when you boil it down, you get these seemingly paradoxical or certainly unusual ways of reasoning and the way things work, which doesn't plug into our everyday life very well. Nature seems to have these like artistic tricks hiding in there. And I love that idea of delving in and looking for the foundations and finding these really rich structures in there, which, you know, we can present as art, because it comes out richer than any art that I could make myself. And then once we've got these visual systems, the challenge is how to, you know, interpret them musically, for example. So that's a whole other challenge. There are a lot of musicians that do, you could have the music being purely generative, but I find that then it often misses. For me, I want the music to be emotionally engaging, and that means having particular structures. So I try to embed this, some sort of generative aspect or some sort of mapping aspect, but then I also add a lot of human composition on top of that, so that ultimately I want the music to sound nice and to be accessible and to carry an emotional message, as well as showing the structure, as well as delivering concepts of the structure. So for example, I did a project on Penrose tiling, which again was another really beautiful natural system. Well, a mathematical system, but relating to nature, I suppose, in the sense that mathematics does. And it was just an aperiodic tiling system. So I was able to put an aperiodic rhythmical system in for the music. So it was a simple way of embedding the structure in there, but then still having flexibility to put what melodies and chords and still making music as I wanted to. And that's what I generally look for. How can I put some sort of structure in there relating to the idea? Or at the minimum, once I've got the visual idea, how can I score to that? That's my main ways of linking the music to the visual and trying to tie it all together.
So as you perform, I don't know how fluid or how responsive you are to different venues. And just hearing you speak, you're talking about the beauty of the laws of nature and the beauty of the laws of the universe. I had a conversation recently with Rupert Sheldrake, and he was talking about, well, the laws of nature aren't necessarily fixed, which I'm just wondering what your reflections are on that, because
Rupert was at the gig at the Barbican actually on the weekend last week. Yeah, I've got Rupert's books. So what did you want me to answer about that? I've just got...
It's not specific, but I'm just thinking, you know, going to AI and how that's changing the way we think and communicate. And Rupert, he speaks about the laws of nature not being fixed. And I just, you know, wonder what your reflections are on that.
I suppose you might say that the constants of nature are not fixed. One of his ideas, I think, is about the speed of light having changing, not being constant. So you could have constants of nature which change over time. And actually, there was some studies that came out only in the last few weeks. I believe it's to do with dark energy changing over time and weakening over time. So things that seem constant may not be constant over huge timescales and huge distances and all the rest of it. But you could still presumably have a law that sort of yields that change in a natural constant. So you could still Because ultimately, if you had natural law itself, all of it not being constant, then you're going to have some sort of really messy system, and which at certain times and places will give rise to life. It would almost turn into a sort of Boltzmann brain scenario where if you've got enough randomness out there, then molecules happen to bunch together in the right sort of way that someone becomes conscious of being alive just because the particles would happen to be bouncing around in the right way. You almost get that sort of scenario emerging from no law. But it's certainly, I think it's a really good way to go where, and I'm getting totally out of my depth here, but I'm going to talk anyway. But I think it's a really good way to go when philosophers and scientists try to build systems with the least possible caveats, essentially. And saying there's no, just allowing things to be random or changing in their own way is somehow more satisfying as a natural system than saying it has to be like this and it has to be like this and it has to be like this. Because then it's, well, who made it like that? Whereas if you can just say, oh, these things can all just be flexible and be more free, and it still gives rise to the world we see, then that model that achieves that is a lot more appealing. And that's something that Stephen Wolfram talks about a lot as well with his hypergraph systems. Stephen Wolfram's someone that I love, and cellular automata feature quite heavily in my projects. I've done a few of these projects with the guy called Jazzer Giles, and also Andy Lomas. He's a mathematician that does a lot of these beautiful cell morphogenesis simulations, which again link back to this world of simulated life and simulated complexity, and how really simple rules, iterative rules, can give rise to really rich, complex behavior. Wolfram's a big proponent of that side of things. And his latest ideas do revolve around a lot of this essentially seeding with randomness, and how, when put in the right context, you can get a lot of what we see of the rules of the world around us from not needing to put too many rules in. And I think that's a great way to go if it can be made to work. But I couldn't answer that question, basically. But it's certainly an interesting one.
It's interesting going down the avenue of AI, and I guess none of us can answer it, but like the randomness in the self-learning system, we can talk about whether consciousness can emerge from that. But you mentioned back there Emergence. I think that was your debut audiovisual show.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like the first album where I realized, okay, what I want to do is I want to use some scientific ideas and make visuals around these ideas and tell a sort of science-related narrative, which I score to and can present as a sort of live experience. And Emergence was the first one, which all the subsequent projects sort of fit into that, because Emergence, is the way I presented it at least, was this sort of grand scientific narrative from law, some sort of structure, to the physical world and cosmos and then planets and evolution, and eventually humans come along and all the complexities that arise there. But it was this sort of narrative that all the other projects can sort of slot into somewhere or other. That overall narrative is still one that I often apply in my shows. For my live shows, I don't pre-plan the structure. I generally try to interact with the audience and with the space. And I've got so many of these projects, I try to fit them all into a unique story each time. But the Emergence narrative is a framework that often exists underneath there, because it's a nice way of making sense of it, essentially. Like, we get to see natural systems and non-human things, and then later evolution, and then later humans come along, and then it all gets really messed up and intense towards the end when the humans are there, like, wrecking everything. So it sort of fits musically as well for a flow of a set. So it's one that that Emergence project is one I keep coming back to, in a sense.
You know, you surprised me in this conversation, because when I went into it, I thought, oh, he is an audiovisual artist who maybe didn't have his home firmly in the sciences. So he brings it into this other realm. But I feel like listening to you, I wonder, do you feel you're an educator, a kind of philosopher? Because I get a different sense than what I was expecting.
I mean, when people ask me, I'll say I'm a musician. Primarily, I make music, but I love ideas. I love aesthetics, and I love ideas, and I love to learn, and I'm curious. And also, it's just on a purely selfish level, when I do these projects, I learn so many beautiful things and get to work with all these amazing video artists and scientists and chat to interesting people. So I'm doing it for my own learning as well. And I guess there is a potentially an educational sort of aspect in there, that although I think most people don't really engage on that level. I think most people that are interested in my music, a lot of them just know the music. For example, it gets fed to them on streaming services, and they might like the music, or some people like the visuals and they like being in the immersive shows. I think But there are definitely some people, because I chat to them at the end of shows, we always write websites for every album, and I always write lots of explanations about this stuff. And the chats that we're having now, for example, the people that might actually watch this, but yeah, hello, if you're watching this, thank you, or listening. Yeah, I love it when people engage on that deeper level, with because it's all there, and that's what drives me, and that's what I'm really excited about. But I also don't like it when I don't want to be in a situation where people have to care about that stuff to enjoy. They should be able to enjoy the music and the experience of the concert and interpret things in their own way. I don't really like prescriptive art where you have to know everything about it to really enjoy it. You know, it should be, I want my art to be accessible. I want my music to be beautiful or emotional, irrespective of if anyone cares about the distribution of the primes or whatever, you know, because it's not all about that. So yeah, anyway, I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yes, it does. For me, for someone who's visual, as a painter, it really helps me understand vaguely some of these ideas that you're discussing. And has it always been for you that you needed to make something in order to understand it?
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a, I learn by playing with things rather than by reading about them, definitely. My music has really been, I've barely done any musical training. I don't watch how-to videos. I just sit down and get something, the synth or a system, and just play with it. And that's how I did my research as well. When I was working in the sciences, I was doing computational biology, and it was all, there was no way of doing it. I just had to play with systems and experiment with ideas and code them and then see what they did and try to move forward by toying around with things. And that's been my approach musically, definitely.
And what were you like as a child? What were those early experimentations that you were doing?
I was very quiet and shy, and would have never believed that my job would have been being a performer, because I hated, like, you know, the school play or anything. I'd be terrified. So it's an unusual sort of job I found myself in on that front. But I think just in the end, I just found when you're really passionate about something, it totally changes the dynamic of how you interact with that and present it. So it's very natural for me to perform in a sense because I love and I believe in the ideas and I care about them. And also, I do play often behind these big gauze screens. So, in that sense, it is more of a introverted performance than the regular one. Again, I love to present, I want to present the art and the ideas in front of myself. It's not supposed to be about me. It's supposed to be about the ideas I'm presenting. So that's why one of the reasons why I play behind these big gauze screens. And also just, the screens create this huge spectacle and I can have these huge immersive presentations of the ideas, which, yeah, I think is a more powerful way of presenting them.
Yeah, and how your music, your audiovisual presentations engage with space is also very important for you. And you've also engaged with, say, the Zaha Hadid architects. And last year, you were, I believe, the first techno artist to perform at the Acropolis in Athens. And just tell us about that spatial element of your work.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, space is something that has been quite a focus for the last 10, 15 years, ever since I started delving into music production seriously. It's something I've always been interested in, and I early on started working with different spatial audio systems, but also working with binaural and how you can create the sense of a space within a piece of music. I think it ties back to wanting to communicate ideas more intensely. So when you use space as a musical tool, you can make it much more visceral. If you get the sense of a sound coming from behind you, the natural sort of evolved reaction is we better pay attention. Something's behind me. You can engage more. You can engage the sort of raw, evolved emotions on that level when you use space. But also, I think something about music for me and arts and science has always been beautiful escapism. And using space as a tool massively increases how much you can escape into something when you're lost inside some beautiful, surreal world. It's just a very pleasurable thing to do, really. And I mean, that's, again, the way I write music is sometimes I'll sit down and I'll think, oh, I want to make a really simple piece of music that really punches through on a big system and is really direct. And I'll sit there and I'll work on it. And then I'll work on it. And eventually I realize that I just haven't done that. I've made this really complicated thing with all these little bits because that's what I enjoy. When I'm sitting in front of, you know, in my studio working, I want to be lost in it. And I don't want to be thinking about everyday things. I want to be lost in this sort of somewhere better than every day. And spatiality and sound and also lots of layers and fine details and fine structure comes from that sort of emotional drive to want that from music. So yeah, space is important there. And then the other thing with space is just the link to the visual side. When you're working on music that ties to visual ideas, space is a very natural thing that connects the two. If you're working with binaural panners or spatial audio, you can put sounds in certain positions and have them moving in space in a way that paints a picture or represents a structure. And then the visual aspect of it, again, will paint the picture or represent the structure. So there's a very natural connection when you start working with visuals a lot and music a lot that space becomes quite an important thing to play with.
And then, you know, so going into your dialogues with architecture, the space is where your work has been performed. We're talking about the Acropolis, or very different on the contemporary spectrum, Zaha Hadid architects. How did they inspire your imagination? What is that process like?
Yeah, I mean, I love working with historic sites. I've done a few events and installations working in old cathedrals. We did one with the Andan Festival in Leuven, and then in Carlisle Church in Belfast with the ABA Festival guys. And then obviously the Acropolis and lots of other venues where I love venues where I can turn up and map projections onto architecture so that you can present the ideas of, you know, the imagery, but you also augment the structures that are already there. And you can, particularly when you're using old historic buildings, they come with so much, I don't know what the word for it is. They're full of feeling and ideas before you already from the history and what you associate them with. So then when you that embeds itself into the music and the visuals that you're presenting. So you get this extra layer of, yeah, engagement and emotion and ideas coming through, which I love. So yeah, whenever I can, I try to use, you know, project. And also I generally use projectors rather than these screens for that reason, so that I can use the architecture and try and make the show itself interact with. I just find it more, well, it's just adds to the storytelling, I think. And it just makes it feel more special. We're all used to going to clubs and festivals or whatever, that the big black box of the club, and there's a sound system and there's a screen, and you know, we're all used to that. But when you go to somewhere crazy historic architecture and you're having a party inside that and there's all these moving things, it just feels more, yeah, it's just the extra magic, basically.
And we should say, for those who haven't seen, sometimes your audiovisual dialogues are the marble coming to life in a kind of new age technological. It just describes some of the, visually what we might be seeing in some of these immersive projects.
Yeah, that was from Seme. I was interested in classic Italian sculpture and painting, and worked with an artist called Usato and a dancer to map human movements to these simulations of sculptural form, so it looked like there was these living sculptures and living paintings and things. Yeah, that was an interesting process.
Yes, and you've also, for COP26, you incorporated, just tell us about the project, you incorporated the voices of Pope Francis and Greta Thunberg, and what is that like to bring your music to, I think, if not the most, one of the most urgent problems of our times?
Yeah, that was an interesting project as well. That was Tom Mustill, director, and then Kevin and Padraig McLaughlin. And they were also directing, making the animation for a, you know, for an awareness film for COP26. And then all the vocal stems came in, and it was Greta Thunberg and the Pope and Nico Rosberg. And I can't remember, there was like 50 sort of very high-end celebrities that whose voices I had to then mix in with the music and play around with. And it was a really beautiful project. And then it was projected on the Opera House, I think, in Glasgow. I think it was in Glasgow, the COP26. So yeah, that was just a commission project, which we all believed in. It wasn't a paid thing, as far as I remember. It was something we all did to try and tell a story around awareness, essentially. People are very aware, I guess, now. It has changed a lot since, you know, the last 10 years. So doing these sorts of projects is important.
Yeah, and your own feeling about the beauty and wonder of the natural world that we see sometimes in your, you know, video projections of the birds and their movement.
So yeah, The Birds is by Yoshi Sadioka. That's the Fibonacci sequence project from the new Seme project. So Yoshi is another long-term collaborator based in New York, and he's been specializing in these really amazing sort of overlays of flying birds with mathematical systems and linking bird flight into different geometric forms. So he got these simulated bird flights to paint out the Fibonacci sequence. And then as it hit the gridded cross lines where it reached the next values on the sequence, if that makes sense, the drummer, Quick Bass, would play the drum hits in time with the mapping of the sequence. So that, again, that was like this question I said earlier. We're working with an idea because it's part of the brief. It's to do with Italy. Okay, Fibonacci, the Fibonacci sequence. And it's a famous Italian historic sort of scientist. how do we do it visually? Okay, we can paint the picture out visually with mapping the numbers to the spiral. And then, okay, rhythmically, that also, if that's moving, that spiral's getting painted at a constant rate. It's hitting the points at a particular rhythmical intervals, and the drummer can play those intervals. So then we end up with a musical structure which maps to the visual structure, and then I can play the synths around that. And the whole thing starts to build around the idea that we're working with. To you, that was a nice, another example of how to tie it all together. But more generally, you're saying comments on the beauty of nature. I mean, for me, there's, you've got the sort of nature of, I don't know, a tree or a leaf or a beautiful sunset, these sort of classical natural sights that we all agree are beautiful. But for me, what's even more beautiful is the systems, going back to this reductionism, it's the systems that give rise to those things. For example, Thomas Vans, who I work with a lot, he does a lot of, based in Paris, he does a lot of these mixtures of different types of liquids, getting these liquids and then just big macro scale lenses to take footage of them. So it's tiny scale systems in basically in a Petri dish, for example, but it looks like stars and cosmic events. And it, you know, when he films these tiny things, it looks like the cosmos basically. And you think, well, why does this tiny thing in a teacup look like the cosmos? And again, it's a reflection of there are natural laws underlying things which operate at tiny scales and operate at huge scales. And it's when you see something like that, you're seeing some of the aspects of these laws in operation. And for me, that's the really beautiful thing. It's the whenever you can find something simple that can tie together all these disparate things that we see in the world around us. And then that thing, the beauty of that thing itself is this really purified form of the beauty we see around us. So again, I guess I'm trying to justify my views on why something's beautiful. But often I think when you can explain a lot with a little, that can be beautiful. And the aesthetics of that, the aesthetics of systems that do that are often beautiful.
Yes. So I'm wondering, I know, of course, you play your own instruments, you're creating it electronically. I'm wondering what the advent, I don't know what your experimentations might have been with AI-generated music.
Yeah, I mean, I've experimented with various AI tools. Simplant is quite good. Simplant 2, they've got this, it'll learn, you can drop any sound in and it will learn how to recreate similar versions of that sound that you can then play back and manipulate, which is quite useful. And then AMI, the AI system, which does like endless mixes in the style of particular that they've got. You know, I sent them a load of my stems and it'll sort of endlessly recreate something that sounds a little bit like me. And then Rob Clough has a great new AI tool. Is it called the Combobulator? I have a feeling it's called something funny like that. I'm just going to look it up because I want to make sure
I wouldn't know.
Right,
I don't feed AI. I only have conversations about it.
I'm just going to look it up. Yes. Data Mind Audio Combobulator. Again, this is Rob Clough is someone that works on my record label, Mesh. He's a really amazing artist and researcher and ex-scientist. It's a style transfer tool. So again, I've submitted all my stems and a bunch of other artists have. So what you can do is you play a melody or a rhythm, and then it will map the style of different artists across to that. And it's interesting, the way they're doing things as well is it's a specific artist. So you'll buy, for example, the mapping for a particular artist so that the artists are getting paid as well. Because obviously one of the big challenges with AI stuff is what to trend on. Are the original artists getting credited, getting paid? You know, what's the system that's happening? How do we keep supporting artists essentially whenever we can replicate a lot of things they can do? So they've got a great solution there in terms of a model when it's trained on a particular artist that the funds flow through to them and this sort of thing, it's all credited. So that's another example of a tool which is really interesting. All that said, none of these tools are, I still prefer doing things the way I usually do, and I'll keep experimenting with AI tools. And for me, they are another tool which will be useful and which I'll continue to integrate. And visually as well, it's the same thing. How can we use these tools in a way where we're not replicating people's work, that you're not replicating what humans can already do. You're trying to do things which are doing something new, essentially. And if we ever get to the point, obviously, you can potentially get to the point of just typing, it'll give you a finished piece of music, which yeah, could flood the musical market with loads of stuff. But I mean, obviously, it won't be much fun for people making that because I love making music. I have to do it, otherwise they go mad, you know. So I'm not going to stop doing that. But yeah, it's opening a lot of doors. But I also think there's plenty of, more than plenty, there's this huge overhype every day. This changes everything. Here's this mad thing. It's all clickbait. There's so much overhype at the same time as there being a lot of potential. But it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
As you've just heard, Max Cooper's work illuminates some of our most pressing issues as organic beings, dealing with, and in many cases creating with, inorganic systems we have built. When I reflect on Max's music, it seems to sit at the perfect intersection between these two worlds, revealing that maybe the division is less real than we usually like to think. His utilization of natural numerical sequences, commonly found in nature such as the Fibonacci or Penrose tiling within his music, is an inspiring reminder of the patterns that exist both in nature and in us. And yet, Max's artistic output isn't just limited to a mechanical, numerical lens, but also equally incorporates the subjective human experience, which he rightly makes a point of emphasizing. For myself as a songwriter and musician who enjoys experimenting with electronic elements in this art form, I very much relate to the idea that making music is, for some of us anyway, a compulsion, and that to avoid doing it can create an immense lack in one's life. This push and pull between compulsion and choice, nature and machine, these things are real opposites, and yet in an artistic space such as this, they often blend together and can become at times indistinguishable. Is being a musician or a creative in general with an artistic impulse something quite difficult to articulate that one feels deep in their bones, the same as a machine that is programmed to perform a set of actions? That's a question I'll leave to you, but on the front of creativity, the intersection of human biology and instinct with technology has always been there. Think of the early humans who utilized rocks and bones to make sound for the first time. Even there, there's the human and the external technology, but both are needed to create something which neither could alone. Maybe that is the answer to so many of these moral questions surrounding art making. That to attempt to replace either of these crucial elements would be a huge mistake, and that creativity at its heart is a mysterious impulse that we're still struggling to understand. Maybe instead of trying to control it, to wield this natural impulse to our own ends, instead we should allow it to guide us, to follow it, and allow it to use us as its technology, to let our inner stirrings take shape through the increasingly powerful mediums we have access to today, including things such as AI. I'll leave you with a quote from Brian Eno, a pioneering ambient and electronic musician. Here, Eno is referencing Roy Ascott, another artist who meshes programming and cybernetics creatively. Stop thinking about artworks as objects and start thinking about them as triggers for experiences, Roy's phrase. That solves a lot of problems. What makes a work of art good for you is not something that is already inside it, but something that happens inside you. So the value of the work lies in the degree to which it can help you have the kind of experience that you call art. Now, back to the interview.
Yes, and I want to discuss your label Mesh and its mission, which brings together the arts and sciences. But first, on this point, you know, the world is shrinking as our environment becomes increasingly shaped by technology. As you know, many AI programs are developed with a specific focus or specialization in mind, such as healthcare, environmental monitoring, financial analysis, or autonomous vehicles. So as we look to more challenges on the horizon, do you think AI will empower people to achieve creative freedom? Or will we rely on it to automate our lives and way of thinking? You know, what kind of guardrails and governance do you think we need?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've always mentioned with this is just in academia, whenever you write a paper, you have all your references and your sources, and that's just the system. And a lot of AI, that sort of thing would be very helpful, you know, whenever you can see essentially what things have been trained on, and an automated way of linking back to sources, and transparency essentially is one of the things I think would be helpful. But yeah, I mean, it's a minefield. I don't have the solutions and I'm not deep into that world, so I shouldn't comment on it too much really, other than it's something that is interesting and I'm hoping for, you know, it's exciting. I'm hoping for lots of new tools. Another thing to mention is when I write music, I'm not proficient at playing any instrument, and I already use tons of generative techniques. I build systems to wander around different timbres and to sample different notes from scales. And my process is already full of generative systems. I set up these things that sort of wander around, have a bit of life of their own, and I'm taking little bits of them and I'm interacting with them. And a lot of that's really similar to how I imagine, well, and I already do work with AI systems. They're collaborators. And in that sense, it's not as different as what I used to do as people might think. It's just becoming more obvious. And I think the history of art is full of these things. I get there's that Vermeer, you know, the artist who did these hyper-realistic paintings and people couldn't believe how amazing they were. And in more recent years, people have come to realize that the way they did it was with lenses and taking real scenes and focusing light onto canvas and copying the color from the real color to the painted one. It's like a procedural system for creating art. And that's always been the case. And I think most artists do have procedural systems that you follow through to create art. So I think there's a difference between the reality of how art's made and the perception of how art's made. And with AI, that difference is being made clear, I guess.
Sure. But with respect to Vermeer, using a camera obscura to just, you know, capture an existing image is nothing really like the persuasion and influence on culture, society, democracy, literature, and art that AI can have on our lives as we know it. So I think AI is a big leap from the camera obscura, you know, a box that projects an image and light. You know, Vermeer didn't have a black box to ask, paint me a girl with a pearl earring. The thing is, I think for me, the AI doesn't leave spaces or silences to struggle and think things through. Actually, I was moved by something that Nick Cave, the singer-songwriter, wrote. He suggests that ChatGPT's intent is to eliminate the process of creation. He says it's fast-tracking the commodification of the human spirit by mechanizing the imagination, rendering our participation in the act of creation as valueless and almost unnecessary. It's almost like, why strive? Why bother with the artistic process and its accompanying trials? As a composer, what do you say?
We definitely, all that said, you know, we definitely need transparency, essentially. You know, craft requires sweat. And when you have a piece of art that's crafted, and when I make a piece of music, it's always painful, always difficult. And I have sleepless nights and stress and, you know, beauty and all the blood and the sweat and the tears go into the process. And I feel like you can hear that and you can, you know, see it. And that's all the great artists I know. You can see the toil as part of their craft in the final thing. And with AI, it's like, yeah, you don't need any toil at all, really. But the thing is, when there's no toil, there's no human expression. What you're getting is a machine that's representing you, creating something that looks like art, but there's no emotion or human expression behind that. So I think ultimately, it's a good thing if we start becoming aware of these things, because instead of looking at a piece of art or listening to a piece of music on a really surface level and just saying, how does it look or how does it sound? When we look at it, we say, why is this piece of art the way it is? Why did someone make this? What does it mean? And actually, for me, if AI pushes us to move more to that way of interacting with art, that's actually a really good thing, because we're getting more to the essence of what art is, which is communication between humans. Like, why did this person feel they should make that? And what does that say about where they lived or who they were or how I live my life or how I should feel? That's where art starts to become much more effective as an actual tool to help people and to enrich our lives, rather than just a really pure surface level. That looks nice, that doesn't look nice, that sounds nice, that doesn't, you know. So in that sense, I think it could push us into quite a good place.
Yeah, it makes us question also our purpose on this planet. And if everything we can do can be replicated, then we better do more. So as you think about the future and education and the teachers and collaborators that have been important, what did they share with you? And what for you is the importance of music and the arts?
The people I've worked with have been amazing inspirations and teachers. Going back to my PhD supervisor, John Brookfield, he was just an amazing person. And he's still an amazing person. Not that I'm in touch with him that much anymore, occasionally. But he was just really, I mean, one of the most clever people I've ever got to spend a lot of time with, really, and learn things about how to tackle problems. But just with a passion for learning and just endless curiosity and endless creativity that I've often, when I'm stuck, I could sort of, you know, it's like, what would this person do in this scenario? So he was definitely a big help and inspiration. Andy Lomas is another one who I've mentioned, a visual artist, a mathematician who I started chatting to many years ago during the first my early visual audiovisual projects, and a collaborator that I've been working with in many years since. Also Kevin and Patrick McLaughlin, the McLaughlin brothers from Sligo. They're just really amazing creatives coming from a very different angle. Andy Lomas being, and John Brookfield being, very technical, mathematical sort of scientists. And McLaughlin's are sort of wild creatives that just full of human expression and full of emotion and amazing ideas, but also with that real toil and the real like obsessive attention to detail. And yeah, that they're big inspiration, how they work and all the projects I've done with them, so many of them. And the quality of their work pushes me to try and improve the quality of my work to live up to theirs, really.
And your work has also been in conversation with, I think, Bruce Brubaker and Philip Glass. And how have those other musicians, how have they inspired your work?
Yeah, the project with Bruce Glassforms was, I mean, Philip Glass has always been, since I was a child, some of the few pieces of music that I did engage with before finding electronic music. Glass was definitely amongst those. And it, essentially, I didn't realize at the time, but I engaged with Philip Glass because it's basically someone playing techno on a piano, you could say. It's repetitive structures and the emergence of complexity from seemingly simple form. And that, again, that links to the aesthetic ideas I was mentioning before in terms of visuals. But the same thing applies musically. When you can get a simple musical form and iterate and you have emergent complexity, that's a beautiful thing. And Philip Glass is, you know, one of the masters of that. So I'd always loved his music. And then this opportunity, it was a commission from Festival in Paris that were doing a week of all Glass. He was there playing and all his different things were getting performed. And they, again, similar to the recent Semé one, they wanted an electronic interpretation of this sort of something from more of the classical world. So I delved into that project with Bruce Brubaker, and he reworked a lot of Glass's pieces with the help of Alexander Randon, the software developer who built it, you know. I wanted a way of interacting with the live playing of the Glass pieces. So we had this MIDI-enabled grand and then this custom software system that allowed me to modulate the MIDI coming from the grand piano to have the synths sort of wander around what Bruce was playing without needing any predefined structures and no predefined audio or MIDI. It could all be live generated. And that was thanks to Alexander Randon that we were able to do that as well. So yeah, that was a really interesting project.
Just finally, as you think about the future, I mean, we're facing a lot of maybe existential crises. We're living in these fast accelerating times. We're talking about AI and the future and the designing a future that we want to live in. Just as you reflect on all those things and the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I think the arts are important to teach us what we are on a deeper level than the sciences can. On a complementary level, the sciences don't teach us everything. And we're moving as the sciences become ever more dominant. And technology becomes ever more dominant, the arts become ever more important for us to stay in touch with the things that the sciences can't tackle, what it's actually like to be a person, what's actually important. We can have this endless progress inside this capitalist machine for greater wealth and longer life and more happiness according to some sort of metric, or, you know, we can try and quantify society and push it forward. Ultimately, we all have to decide what's important to us as humans. And we need the arts to help with that. So I think what's important really is just exposing ourselves to as many different ideas as we can and being open-minded and trying to learn about all facets of life so that we can understand each other as well. And the arts is an essential part of that.
Indeed. I think curiosity, creativity, and kindness are at the core of consciousness and are universally available for all of us to tap into. So thank you, Max Cooper, for inviting us into your imaginative world, for sharing your appreciation of the beauty and simplicity underlying forms, and for your audiovisual creations that open pathways of understanding between science and art, past and present, and inspire empathic inquiry that we may discover better ways of thinking and being. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thanks for taking the time to prepare the interview, and you clearly I've done a lot of research. Thank you very much.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Lyle Hutchins. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster.
Associate text editor was Sophia Reeser. The music featured on this episode was Palestrina Secut, Cardano Circles, Fibonacci Sequence, and Scarlatti 141. Music is from Seme and is courtesy of Max Cooper.
We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.